prisons America's school of choice? Well, that's provocative, and it's come about through a lot of thinking of my own on the past 2 years of political events, police violence, etc. I'd like to start with a quote from Leo Tolstoy from his novel Resurrection. It is just as if a problem had been set to find the best, the surest means of depraving the greatest number of people, thought Neil Doof, while getting an insight into the deeds that were being done in the prisons. Every year, hundreds of thousands were brought to the highest pitch of depravity. And when completely depraved, they were liberated to spread broadcast the moral disease they had caught in prison. I've had some close encounters with schools and prisons in my life. As an educator, I'd been a university professor at institutions of higher ed in Missouri, Illinois, and Texas. I've taught English, composition, literature, communications, education, and criminal justice. My life as an academic underwent a career change in the mid-70s. When I made a decision to pursue developing education programs for truly at-risk students in a large urban jail in San Antonio, Texas. I was recruited by a good friend from my undergraduate days in the St. Louis Archdiocesan Seminary, Father Harry Martin, who was the chaplain at the Bexar County Jail in San Antonio. A newly completed jail addition had just been finished that included closed-circuit radio and television broadcasting capabilities. And there were no education programs at the institution. And fortunately, the jail had just been placed under a federal consent decree to reduce overcrowding and to provide programs for 1,200 inmates. I began with volunteers. I secured foundation and governmental grants and had the political education of my life. My work in San Antonio resulted in award-winning programs that included a licensed GED testing center, development of the first computer-assisted education program in the United States in a jail, and permanent funding by county government of my programs and professional staff. When I left the county jail, I then worked as a program consultant for jails and prisons across the country in 24 states. I worked with architects, governmental planners, and nonprofit organizations. It was rewarding, exciting, and frustrating. I began to feel like I was a finger in the dike of the rising tide of incarceration and the construction of more prisons. Later, when I decided to pursue theology studies at Thomas Starr King's School for the Ministry in Berkeley, California, I became an advocate for institutional change, working as an intern with the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee's National Moratorium on Prison Construction. This advocacy work led to my working as an alternative sentencing consultant with Dr. Jerome Miller and his new organization, the National Center on Institutions and Alternatives. Dr. Miller had been a Clark lecturer here at First Church back in the 90s. The focus of my work with the moratorium and NCIA was upon finding alternatives to incarceration. This was satisfying work, not as financially rewarding, and still as frustrating given the political realities. All told, I worked as a jail administrator and corrections teacher consultant for over 2 decades. As a result of that work, I've come to some conclusions about the connections and similarities between educational and corrections institutions. In 1787, Benjamin Rush, a prominent Universalist and a signer of the Declaration of Independence, met with Benjamin Franklin and a group of Quakers and other free thinkers in Philadelphia to devise an acceptable and humane answer to the usual punishments of torture, mutilation, and execution. Their answer was based on the concept of penance and forgiveness. Offenders were to be incarcerated to give them time to meditate and do penance for their crimes. Today's jails and penitentiaries can be traced directly to that meeting. The penitential, a rehabilitative model devised by these well-intentioned men, was composed of solitude, reflection, and study of the Bible. In effect, this model of prison was not unlike a school, albeit a school with severe restrictions and sanctions. Today, we still think of prisons as schools for training criminals in the craft of crime. As more and more students, particularly African-American males, have encounters with juvenile detention centers, adult and juvenile probation, jail, prison, probation, parole, they have more exposure to crime and criminal ways. These schools are expensive, too. A year of imprisonment now costs an average over $30,000 per year, not too far from the cost of tuition at a college. According to the Vera Institute of Justice, the average cost of housing an inmate in 2012 was $31,286. Annual costs vary. Kentucky has the lowest at $14,600. Prisons compete with educational budgets in every state. In fact, the current state budgets reveal that every state now spends less on education than on corrections. While politicians argue over allocating resources for schools and colleges, the prison industrial complex usually gets their way and whatever they want. The call for more prisons by politicians gives evidence that prisons have by default become the public school of choice, especially for people of color. Jails and prisons of our country are very real reflections of how we feel about others and ourselves. The fact that these institutions turn out people worse than when they went in reveals, in effect, an inherent collective death wish. The mad march to build more prisons, to incarcerate more people, and to ignore the roots of social problems is a direct analogy to the nuclear arms buildup. No politician would dare suggest that we slow or stop this rush to incarcerate more and more people. But we cannot achieve peace without a dismantling of our domestic weapons of species suicide, prisons and jails. There's talk among liberals like myself about the coming demise of corrections and jails and prisons. This talk is premature, although I think the eventual abolition is to in the future. All we have to do is look at some models, especially European and Scandinavian models. We must work with this situation we have today and strive to transform these penal institutions into houses of transformation instead of houses of punishment. If there's one thing my career in criminal justice has taught me, it is that punishment doesn't do much except lead to the need for more punishment. All contemporary studies on child abuse and domestic violence point out that abusers and batterers were themselves abused and physically battered as children. I'm not surprised then that our detention facilities burst at the bars with more and more offenders. Until we as a nation decide to deal with people who transgress in ways other than retribution, I don't think the abolishment of houses of incarceration will be anything but a utopian glimmer in the eyes of educators and social justice advocates. And we are still in a phase, although it seems to be diminishing, where the treatment of offenders, where people say rehabilitation doesn't work. Just look at the recidivism rate, 65% come back to prison. We are told daily that incarcerating people for longer and longer periods is a way to stop people from coming back. A negative answer like incarceration does little in the long run beyond creating more jobs for construction workers, prison guards, and administrators. It is effective in keeping people off the streets, particularly, again, African-American males. What about the future costs? More than 2.5 million people are now housed in all the jails and prisons in the United States, the highest rate of incarceration in the world today. Combine that figure with the over 2.5 million people on probation and parole, and you come up with an astounding 3% of the adult population under control of some aspect of the criminal justice system. Percentage of black males in that number is a staggering 35%. Blacks account for 12% of our population. One out of every three black males will be part of the justice system at some time in their life. Given such numbers, one wonders how we can call our nation the land of the free. I doubt that any of our answers to law and order problem are going to get far if we don't address fundamental social questions of adequate housing, nutritious food, appropriate education, and life skills commensurate for coping with the 21st century. As long as our schools often operate like detention centers with their paramilitary structure and legal enforcers, teachers, principals, security, truant officers, we should not be surprised that many students respond with dismay and anger. All too often, our schools become schools for crime. Schools that foster competition through teaching to the test breed winners and losers all too often go to jail. Schools that practice authoritarianism in the classroom develop people who feel they are better than others, even if they have to kill to prove some superiority. Schools must teach human dignity and how to learn responsibility and self-discipline. The fact that many school teachers in our city could now be considered consumers of weapons and combat gear was reinforced for me a few years ago by a personal experience on the north side of our city. I was retained as a consultant for an educational software company that was marketing it as a cognitive skills program for at-risk students. And they were going to pilot it at one of the St. Louis City schools up on the north side. There I was a witness, almost a party, to a bit of the daily combat in the area. During the lunch break after the presentation, at the suggestion of a school administrator, I moved my car from street parking to the supposedly more secure staff parking lot on the school grounds. Pulling into the driveway, I found my route was blocked by a car whose driver was firing a handgun at two teenage boys 20 yards away who had bolted from their own car. Four shots were fired, all missed the fleeing boys who ran inside the school I was visiting. The shooters fled, not pursued by anyone. School security police listened to the teens' story and went back to their business of guarding the inside of the building. One of the officers told me it was just some kids that didn't know how to shoot straight. Said he thought it was too bad they weren't more accurate. The neighborhood could do without their likes, both shooters and victims. The callousness of his remark was haunting in its acceptance of the war zone mentality. The whole incident was just another unremarkable event in a part of the city that has become desensitized to the violence and disregard for life that abounds in the area. I'm reminded of the desensitization of guards and inmates in a prison. A prison, a ghetto, an inner city school. The parallels are obvious and frightening. While my life was briefly at risk during this incident, the lives of the families in the neighborhood are put on the line night and day. Just as prisons can only attempt to educate inmates a few hours a day, so too schools only have students a small portion of the day. The education of the streets and the neighborhood continues unrelentingly 24 hours a day. No wonder inner city schools are inadequate havens and agents of positive change. A solution for city schools lies not in the building of new schools in crumbling and dangerous neighborhoods, but in the rebuilding of those neighborhoods. The dangerous environment of inner city schools needs administrators and staff equipped to deal with the realities of that assignment. Using such school assignments as training grounds for neophyte teachers, or worse yet, as punishment for some political transgression, does not better the lot of the young students who often risk their lives making it through the day in their neighborhoods. Young people may be thought to be safe from guns and knives in the schools secured by security officers and metal detectors. Once on the street, as I saw firsthand, everyone is at risk. These schools need re-education of administrators and staff. It should take the form of a leadership training program for teachers and administrators focusing on the realities of urban education. This at-risk at leadership program would incorporate the latest progress, cognitive development programs, security precautions, anger management, and behavior modification. If we can't see our way to paying any city inner city educators the equivalent of hardship pay for a difficult assignment, at least we should begin realistically preparing them for the inner city school experience. If we would take a good look at our social institutions and work toward fostering cooperative approaches to dealing with people, then I believe that real progress could be made toward eliminating ignorance, poverty, and crime. Authoritarian models of family, school, and government do not abolish problems. At best, they only contain them. Dictators get trains running and keep the lid on, but the effect is eventual psychic and physical chaos. Until we have solved these problems of violence and murder, we must keep the perpetrators of these acts separated from the public. Once we've isolated, detained, or incarcerated these people, it becomes society's job to put together institutions and programs that work toward reducing criminal behavior. The real crime in our criminal justice system is of what Carl Menninger aptly calls the crime of punishment. We must work towards transforming jails and prisons into secure treatment centers. Please note I use the word secure because I believe we have the right to be protected from people who have proven by their acts that they are not able to function in a normal environment. Once we have secured our safety from the truly violent, it becomes the duty of every jail and prison to work mightily towards the treatment, training, and education of inmates for eventual reintegration into the free world. Anything in our institutions that trains for crime, lawlessness, and inhuman behavior must be eradicated. Our incarcerated, probated, parole populations are increasing so rapidly that many social critics believe, rightly, that society is in trouble. The numbers of jail and prisons have grown to such an extent, some analysts say the institutions themselves have led to a decrease in crime. How many people would have to be incarcerated? How many prisons and jails built to accomplish that goal? It is a frightening vision. Dehumanization and punishment do nothing to promote goals of social transformation. The experience of incarceration, social removal, is in itself heavy punishment. Offenders are removed from their homes, their families, their occupations, their possessions, from all that defines their personality. This displacement can be the foundation for negative change. Under names ranging from unfreezing to brainwashing by any power that wishes to reform personality structures, such internal change is a common experience of jails, prisons, concentration camps, the military, and even some schools. Additional punishment in terms of harsh treatments, squalid conditions, and a routine of depersonalization degrades individuals and produces further antisocial behaviors. It produces animals, a term commonly heard to describe jailed humans. To change people already caught in vicious or unfortunate cycles, we must remove ourselves from the common view of such people. What they have done, the choices that have brought them to jail or prison, should not prejudice us. Instead, we must remember what kind of people we want to help make them instead of expressing our opinion of what kind of people they seem to be now. Such detachment is not easy, but this philosophy makes it less hard because it says people can change. Human beings are dynamic, constantly being remade through interaction, rather than forever determined by an unchangeable past. And this philosophy is motivating because it places some of the responsibility for what people are on all that are with them. All of us become teachers of one another. People are not born to raise hell. People learn their lessons from parents, neighbors, society. Antisocial behavior, aggressive, malicious, impulsive, uninformed, is taught. The kind and quality of a person's experience will be reproduced in that person's attitudes and actions. Behaviors which bring pleasure or avoid pain are learned. Whoever or whatever has given a person the experiences he or she finds rewarding or which help avoid pain will be that person's teacher. I believe that people truly learn by practice, not just by rote memorization or osmosis. And what we seek out, repeat, and finally learn is determined by social context. Societies change, interests change, technologies change, supply and demand changes. The major needs of our incarcerated population are still self-management skills, literacy and communication skills, and employment skills. It is important that we continue to work to transform and eventually dismantle houses of punishment. Social justice and charity begin at home. We must reach out to witness for peace and justice in the world, but we can only affect world peace when we've begun to change ourselves as well as our institutions, our schools and prisons. We give lip service to schools, we give our dollars to prisons and their construction. Instruments of punishment and vindictive justice take priority over schools. Perhaps schools would get more money if they were presented more as places of punishment rather than as institutions of social progress. The French philosopher Michel Foucault states in his powerful treatise, Discipline and Punish, The Birth of the Prison, that we should not be surprised that prisons resemble factories, schools, barracks, hospitals, which all resemble prisons. Fyodor Dostoevsky is quoted as saying that the degree of civilization of society can be judged by entering its prisons. I think that's still true today. Even truer is another corollary. If you want to understand our culture, take a look at our schools as well as our prisons. I think the two institutions often look more and more alike. When I was a student attending Catholic elementary and secondary schools in St. Louis, I thought school was one of the safest places in my neighborhood. My parish elementary school was adjacent to our church. My high school was part of the church. It was a diocesan seminary for training priests. School was a regimented place, but it was safe and secure. Today's schools, with their large classroom size, inadequate resources, poorly trained teachers, contribute mightily to the high dropout rate of students. And of course, students who drop out of school are at a much higher chance of being incarcerated and swept up into the criminal justice system. To affect change in schools will be to affect change in society. The changes needed in schools, more resources, more diversity, more training, smaller class size, more community involvement, All of these can and should be implemented in our prisons and jails. When we begin to implement some of these ideas, we will truly begin to help schools and prisons become agents for positive social change. What can we do right now to help foster these changes? I think the primary responsibility for all of us today is stay informed and, most importantly, vote. Vote for people who have a humanistic understanding about education and law and order. Voting in our democracy for candidates promoting democratic values is the key to positive change in our correctional and educational institutions. Thank you.